You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the United States claims that Russia has accidentally bombed Iran. Moscow denies it. Tehran appears to suggest that either Russia didn't or that Tehran doesn't much care if Russia did. My guests Jane Kinnamont and Mary Dajewski will be here to try and make sense of that one. And the day's other big stories, including the United States' apparent decision to abandon its expensive and hapless attempts to locate, arm and train relatively non-awful participants in Syria's civil war. The strange suggestion that now of all times is the right time to try reviving Turkey's long dormant ambitions of EU membership, and the decision of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. A good day for Tunisia, arguably an even better one for bookmakers. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to today's show. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Mary Dajewski, columnist with The Independent here in London. Welcome both back to the show. We will start tonight with those suggestions that not quite all of the cruise missiles launched at Syria by Russia from the Caspian Sea got all the way to where they were going. US officials insist that four of the 26 rockets fired by Russia landed somewhere in Iran. Russia, as is traditional, denies this, and for what it may be worth, RT is today quoting an Iranian general, rubbishing the entire yarn. Mary, you have wide experience of Russia. Do we actually have the least idea what happened?
Well, I'm completely flummoxed by this, because when I saw the first reports that four missiles had, as it were, gone missing and might have landed in Iran, my immediate thought was that this was actual natural disinformation. I mean, it seemed so easy to do, to put it out on social media, and it was gaining wide currency. I mean, in a group that I was sort of talking with last night, it was gaining wide currency. It was being accepted as though it was gospel, in part because the Americans had been so clear from the outset that Russia had what they said were unguided missiles, and there were all sorts of potentials for things to go wrong. So I don't know what the truth of it is, but until these missiles show up in some form, exploded or unexploded, then I'm keeping a completely open mind about this.
It is the first rule, I think, of trying to understand any conflict, especially while it's going on, which is just assume everybody is lying until it's demonstrated otherwise. But Jane, would there be anything to be gained by the US in making it up out of whole cloth if they've got absolutely no evidence for it at all?
It could be useful to try to drive a wedge between Russia and Iran. One of the issues here is that the allies who support the opposition are divided internally and amongst each other over what their strategy really is. They haven't seen the same extent of divisions on the other side. There is some speculation that Russia may be making Iran somewhat uncomfortable, especially with reports that unofficially Russian ground troops are going into Syria. And there may be reasons to try to use propaganda to add to the mistrust between those two countries.
See, that right there is an interesting point, though, isn't it, Mary? Because if Russia does deploy ground troops in Syria, and I think I've got this right, you can get a nosebleed very quickly trying to understand Syria at this point. Doesn't that mean that Iran will effectively end up fighting on both sides?
Well, it sows even more confusion in an already confused situation. But I'd also add to what Jane was just saying, which is that, of course, whether or not missiles landed in Iran or Iranian territorial waters or wherever they landed or didn't land, if they were to, in the future, misfire and land in Iran, or indeed anywhere else that isn't actually the targets in Syria, then that is an enormous risk, and it simply adds huge dangers to what is already a totally explosive situation.
Well, it is, of course, not like Russia in the last year or so doesn't have a certain amount of form for launching missiles at things they probably shouldn't have launched missiles at. Jane, should whether or not this has actually happened and really there's no way of knowing, I don't think, that I can think of. Should at least the possibility of such an incident have focused everyone's attention a bit more on the possibility that something like that could happen and how people are supposed to react if they do? I mean, all the nightmare scenarios have been floated over the last few days. What happens if a Russian aircraft shoots down a coalition aircraft or vice versa? Do we at least have any reassurance that this conversation has been had?
Iran would probably have an overriding interest in at least trying to cover it up if it had happened. For Iran and Russia, it's very important that their alliance at least appears very solid. But there are so many horrendous ways in which this could now escalate. We have, of course, seen Russian jets violating Turkish airspace. If that kind of incident is repeated, that is something that could escalate in dangerous ways. The Gulf countries want the Western countries to give them anti-aircraft weapons to pass on to the Syrian opposition. That may not happen, but if it did, that also raises various scenarios as to what would happen if the Syrian opposition successfully shot down a Russian plane.
Because this is a lot of what's going on, Mary, is posturing, it is moving things around the chessboard. It is all fun and games until someone loses an aircraft. Do you have any understanding as yet? And it's been an interesting thing to contemplate over the last couple of years. Any idea of where Russia thinks it's going with this? Is there an end game in sight, or is this Putin just again continually creating strange, ambiguous scenarios to force the West to react?
I think Russia does have an end game, and I think it's a twofold end game. And I think their first priority is to enter the equation and to position themselves for whatever is going to come next, assuming that eventually there'll be some sort of, not exactly peace talks, but some sort of area group talks if things continue this way. And I think the second priority for Russia is the priority that they've had all along, which is less about keeping Assad personally in power than about keeping as much of Syria as is possible together as a unitary state. I think Russia has all sorts of nightmares of Syria becoming another Libya, another Iraq, another Afghanistan, and it sees it as in its own security interests to prevent that happening.
I mean, what do you make of it, Jane? Do you think Russia is pursuing an actual definable definition of success?
In addition to the things that Mary mentioned, there is the ongoing competition with the US, a US that no longer wants to fight a Cold War, but nonetheless, that sort of rivalry seems to be an important factor in Russia's decision making. And so far, it is asserting itself as an international power, not just a power in its own backyard. And it is succeeding in driving a wedge between the US and its traditional allies in the region. Egypt has already essentially backed Russia's intervention. Israel has accepted it and is hosting senior Russian generals to talk about how they can avoid encountering each other's planes as both of them carry out strikes on Syria. And the Gulf countries have just come back from Saudi Arabia, where there is so much anger at what Russia is doing, but there is almost equal anger at the US for what it is not doing.
Mary, final thought on this before we look at Syria from another angle. What's your sense of how the Russian public might see this adventure, and especially how they might see it if Russians are killed or arguably worse still captured by Islamic State?
I think in that second eventuality, then any popularity for involvement in Syria is going to decline very, very fast. And it's going to become a huge political danger for Putin. As of now, however, something very interesting is happening in Russia, which is that all the patriotic fervour that was sort of directed toward operations in Ukraine has been transferred to Syria. And Russians are being regaled every evening on their television news with similar pictures to the ones that sort of entranced the West when the first smart weapons were used and shown on CNN in the first Iraq war. And so Russia is going through a bit of that sort of triumphal, we can do technology just like the West can, that sort of moment.
Okay, well, we'll move along now, because one quantifiable consequence of Russia's intervention has been the United States' apparent decision to bin its $500 million program to train and equip what it quite fondly thought of as moderate opponents of the Assad regime. It has been claimed that American-backed groups have even been among the targets hit by the Russian Air Force, which is testament indeed to the marksmanship of Russian pilots, given that by one count fewer than half a dozen US-trained fighters were yet to be killed or captured by their regime opponents. Jane, this... what we know of this program does appear to be one of the great modern stories of foreign policy hubris. Why hasn't it worked?
From the outset, the US has been looking for fighters that would prioritise US goals in Syria. It was pretty hard for them to find Syrians in a country where, yes, the opposition has had some kind of alliance with the US, but there is a huge amount of suspicion, even among the opposition, about US agendas. That suspicion has got much worse as the conflict has raged on. The vetted people were supposed to essentially sign forms to say that they certainly wouldn't pass their weapons along to any jihadi groups.
Hard to imagine what could go wrong, isn't it?
And indeed, they were supposed to be fighting jihadi groups, not necessarily prioritising the fight against Assad. For most of the Syrian opposition, the priority is the fight against Assad. The US no longer has much credibility helping them. It was extremely hard for them to find people willing to volunteer for a force that was essentially seen as imperialist mercenaries.
Mary, it doubtless occurred to the US foreign policy boffins behind this brilliant scheme that they had a certain amount of, these things are always relative, success, at least in the short term, with a not dissimilar enterprise in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Why couldn't they sell it to Syria?
Well, I think you can look, if you like, at Iraq in between. And they tried very hard to set up a
Indeed
sort of proxy regime in exile. And the whole thing was a complete disaster before it had even started. And I think it was always likely, as Jane said, to be even more of a disaster or even less viable in Syria. But I also think there's another aspect to this. If, as it appears, the Americans are going to either reveal or let slip that they're stopping support for anti-Assad rebels or those particular groups, then that actually vindicates to an extent Russia's position. And it also makes it rather strange that Obama and the Americans have apparently rejected all possibility of cooperating with the Russians. Because if America's prime enemy now is Islamic State, and if that's the enemy that Russia also says is the prime enemy, then why aren't they cooperating?
Just to follow that thought up, though, and I'll put this to you, Jane, and it is kind of a bleak thought, but most thoughts about Syria are. Clearly what the United States wanted to do, or at least what they were looked like they wanted to do, was arm, train, encourage, etc., secular moderates, which is a relative concept. Is it possible that in the context of Syria, relatively speaking, the secular moderates are in fact the Assad regime?
The Assad regime are secular extremists, essentially. There's a spectrum of Syrian opposition. Of course, it is becoming more radical as the conflict becomes more brutal. But Islamic State has been a minority among the opposition groups. There's a large number of other groups. Most of them are Islamist, and that reflects the reality of Syrian politics today. It also reflects the fact that most of the money that has come in to help the opposition has come from regional powers in the Gulf and in Turkey, and the US hasn't made the same kind of commitment to the forces it would like to back as Russia has to the Assad regime, or the regional powers have to the more Islamically leaning ones.
Mary, to follow up that point you made, that in theory, not just Russia and the United States, but pretty much everybody has a common enemy in Syria now in the Islamic State, and that should be the basis for a certain degree of cooperation. Would it not make just as much sense at this point for the United States, in the light of Russia's intervention, just to look at this hideous wasp's nest that is Syria and just think, you know what, if the Russians want it that much, they're welcome to it?
Well, I think there is, but I also think there is a problem for Obama in trying to do that. I think that left to himself, that might indeed be what he thinks. And, you know, you talk to advisors or people who say they have the ear of the White House who tend to think that he is actually doing the minimum that can be done rather than the maximum. The problem is that there is all sorts of pressure on him from Congress and from other political groups in the US, which are continually saying this is a weak president, he's absolutely useless, he's not upholding the interests of national security. And Obama, even though he's in his second and last term, won't be standing for re-election, nonetheless, these are wounding accusations that no American president can really expose himself to.
What do you think of that, Jane? Because it's a fair observation, I think, but it strikes me that it's also in keeping with Obama's general approach to the Middle East. He hasn't gone legacy chasing as so many second termers do by trying to sort of bring peace to the region. He possibly thinks, I've already got a Nobel Peace Prize, what do I need another one for? But he may just recognise that, you know, this never goes anywhere. It always ends messily. Is there, and this is a hypothetical thing, because it's not the sort of thing that Americans ever say out loud, even if it's what they actually think, but what's really stopping America, where Syria is concerned, from just going, why are we doing this? This is not our problem, really. It's an awfully long way from us, and really very little good can come from our involvement.
I think about half of the US administration have been thinking that, while others have thought that this is not an issue that can be contained. But the commitment of the US to overthrowing Assad has been half-hearted for a long time. US defense officials have been saying...
When the US really want to overthrow someone, they get overthrown.
They have the means to do it. And they say very openly, in the case of some senior officials, that regime change might lead to scenarios that could be worse for US interests. So I think that is already a reality, but it is a global problem. I mean, you have foreign fighters going from all around the world, from places as far afield as China, the Philippines or Mongolia, who may now be involved in clashes with Russians in Syria, in the heart of the Middle East. So it's not something that can be seen as a simple local conflict that will just stay where it is.
Mary, above and beyond what the US is doing directly in Syria that at least we know about, which is spearheading this debatably effective air campaign, is there actually anything else they could or should be doing?
Well, other than escalating things to the point where they do actually overthrow Assad. But I think, you know, in some ways the Russians intervened because they felt hugely frustrated that the Americans weren't actually achieving whatever objectives they'd set themselves. So they said, okay, you know, we've given you 2 years, we haven't really done anything to hinder you, and you still haven't done what you said you were going to do. So now the Russians have come along and they're using, so far as you can judge, much more firepower and being much more decisive about achieving their particular objectives. I mean, it remains to be seen how successful they are. But I think there is an extent of trying to show the Americans that, obviously, there's a Russian pride issue. You know, we're still not just a regional power, we're a global power still. But there is also this frustration with America that it wasn't actually doing what it said it was setting out to do.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jane Kinnon-Mont and Mary Dajewski. Coming up next, could the Syrian crisis actually accelerate Turkey's bid to join the EU? The short answer is obviously no. The longer answer will be following after this break.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnon-Mont and Mary Dajewski. And let's look now at Turkey. Its stance, in many respects, has grown notably more bellicose under the influence of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, to the extent that it's now often forgotten that the country is officially still a candidate member of the European Union. Its accession does seem unlikely, given that it would leave EU leaders explaining to their domestic constituency why they now effectively bordered Syria and Iraq, and why 75 million more people had just been granted freedom to move west. But there are, weirdly, some suggestions that the migrant crisis already underway might revive Turkey's chances. Jane, this comes from reports in Turkish newspapers, including Hürriyet, suggesting that the EU's annual report will have an annex attached to it assessing the accession process and sort of, suggesting that it was about to become more of a priority. What would be the point?
I'm pretty sceptical about this one, but as the EU seriously looks again at its policy towards its southern and eastern neighbours, then it may be a time that people start to think about more wide-ranging options than coming out with the usual statements about partnership, which are seen by many of the neighbours as attempts to keep them away rather than attempts to really embrace them. There could be demographic arguments and economic arguments for including a high-growth emerging market like Turkey with quite a young population into an ageing European Union. It seems that the Turkish press are suggesting that it might be linked to Turkey's help with the migrant crisis, but I'm very sceptical, especially as the migrant and refugee issue exposes still quite a lot of debate within the EU over multiculturalism and, you know, these sentiments in some countries that somehow the EU is a Christian bloc. I don't see the consensus within the EU tending more towards a more inclusive approach.
Because in the current climate, Mary, is it even possible to imagine any political leader of a European country standing up and making a case for Turkish accession to the EU?
Well, I'm a little less sceptical than Jane about this, because I think that it is actually just about possible to imagine that, because what's happening at the moment from the European perspective is that Turkey has become a transit country and increasing numbers of people are crossing Turkey in order to get into the European Union. And Turkey is not doing a huge amount to stop them, whether it wants to or not, whether it can or not. The fact is that they have pretty much free passage across to the European Union. So you can make the argument that says, if we have an accession agreement with Turkey, which, say, has a 10-year time frame and then another 10 years after that before Turks are given freedom of movement on an equal basis with the rest of the EU, then Turkey has much more of an incentive to cooperate on not being this sort of transit country. But if you look at it from the other point of view, if you look at it from the Turkish point of view, then I think there's also some interesting arguments, because for the last 5, nearly 10 years, I think, Turkey has appeared to look more to the east than to the west. And it, as much as the Europeans, seem to have become a bit disenchanted with the prospect of joining the European Union. But with what's happening in Syria and the general disorder in the region, and, you know, just the threat from the incursions by Russian planes, I think has laid this on the line. Turkey has suddenly invoked its membership of NATO, which a lot of us had forgotten. And if it also was able to anchor itself in the European Union, not just in the security alliance of NATO, but in the social and trade alliance, then maybe Turkey is starting to take a fresh look at where it should be sort of amalgamated into.
Now, final thought on this one, Jane. Even if it's not going to happen next week, which it clearly isn't, as Mary suggests, this is a process which is at the earliest, you would think, decades away. This would still be introducing into the EU what would become its second biggest country, its biggest military, and possibly an inbuilt civil war. What effect is this going to have on the rest of the EU?
Well, we're already seeing some countries debating leaving the EU, and that, if you're looking longer term over some coming years, might be another argument for Turkey joining, simply to replace and to show that the European Union was something with potential to expand and to grow rather than a declining project.
Okay, well, finally tonight, as this evening's edition of Midori House has once again demonstrated, finding reasons for optimism or celebration in the recent history or likely immediate future of the Middle East is not easy. However, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee have today reminded everyone that it isn't altogether impossible. They have garlanded Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet for helping to lay the foundations of democracy at the spot where the Arab Spring first erupted. Mary, it is, people forget Tunisia because it's a good news story, relatively. It's a word I've said a lot this evening. But it is relative to the rest of the Middle East, which to say it is better than Libya or Egypt, its immediate neighbours. It's certainly better than Syria. What has been different about Tunisia? Why has it been able to succeed again relatively where all around it has been chaos?
In some ways, I mean, just quite simplistically, it's a generally smaller place. And so it's probably easier to make those sort of changes. But I would be a bit more cautious. I think that, yes, the reason I think that the Nobel Committee cited for awarding the prize was that civil war and revolution violence had been avoided. And that is true. And yes, you know, that is a huge achievement. And the continuation has been done without huge repressive measures like we've seen elsewhere. But I think when you go to Tunisia, and I mean, I was in Tunisia earlier this year, and two extremely violent events have happened. We've had the siege at the Bardo Museum, mm-hmm. and we've had the shooting of largely British tourists on Tunisian beach, which has really, I would say, tarnished their record abroad, at least. And the other thing is that if you go... Yes, there has been a degree of political change and there hasn't been a revolution and there hasn't been civil war. But how far there's actually been significant social change, how far the frustrations, especially of young men and a hugely young population, the same as you see right across the region, how far those are being addressed, I think there's a huge amount of frustration setting in.
Jane, I guess a similar question. I haven't been to Tunisia myself since the Arab Spring. I was there briefly in 2002-ish, which is a long time ago now. But compared to other North African, Middle Eastern countries, it did give every impression of just being that slightly little bit better run, better organised. Is it just that it did have better institutions which were able to survive the removal of the dictatorship?
No, I don't think it is only that. We can look at some of these structural factors, but there is a role for human agency, and these organisations that have been given the Nobel Peace Prize really did achieve something quite significant. Tunisia in 2013 was staring extreme social polarisation and possibly civil war in the face. There had been two assassinations, there was a great deal of tension, and the civil society organisations managed to push and shame the political parties into working together. You could easily have had some equivalent of the polarisation that there was in Egypt between the secularists and the Muslim Brotherhood. The secularists in Tunisia are even more secularist than those in Egypt, but they have managed to agree on a transition, certainly not perfect, but much better than it could have been.
You say, Jane, there that the secularists are more secular than the Egyptian ones, but another factor was, and I'll put this to you, Mary, that the Islamists in Tunisia, the Ennahda Party, seem to be that little bit more reasonable than many of their approximate ideological counterparts.
Well, I think not only that, but at least until maybe very recently, there were probably fewer of them. Now, again, I'm not sure how far that is true, because I think the proportion to the population, the number of Tunisian nationals fighting with Islamic State and in general with jihadi
large,
groups
yeah.
is larger than from almost any other country. Now, in a way, you can also argue the opposite, that would say the fact that so many have gone abroad to fight may actually diffuse the situation at home and make those groups more controllable at home. But I would have no evidence for saying that.
Just a final brief thought on this, Jane. You mentioned the role played by those civil society organisations, the General Labour Union and the three others that won the award. Is there an exportable example there, or are these just a phenomena unique to Tunisia?
They can serve as some source of inspiration. There may not be exact equivalents in other countries, but all the Arab countries have different degrees of labour and professional associations, NGOs and so forth. And being reminded that there are some successes is actually extremely important, because the morale of civil society across the Arab world has been badly, badly battered by the violence seen across the region.
We will have to leave it there. Jane Kinnamont and Mary Dajewski, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for this today's edition, I meant to say. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Gaia Lutz and Inez Fresine. Our studio manager was Chris Chauvers. For the next half hour, we're continuing music with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is back with the menu. At 2200, Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell are here for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. With this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.